Return to Northmoor, Meta Episode 3, running time, 39 minutes. Welcome to the third bonus episode of Return to Northmoor. We're going to sit down this time with Fred Hicks of Evil Hat and One Bad Egg. He's going to tell us about his new stuff and his old stuff and what's going on in the world of Fred Hicks. Welcome, Fred.
Thank you.
Let's go ahead and start with a little Fred Hicks street cred. What's your biggest accomplishment, Fred?
It's easy to say Spirit of the Century. It's certainly the biggest thing that I've been a part of. To dial that all the way back, I think my biggest accomplishment, to really go back to the roots of it, was playing in Jim Butcher's Birthright game 13 years ago.
Ah, very interesting. Yeah. Jim Butcher, author of the Dresden Files.
Yep, and things just sort of progressed from there, because I had met Jim online through a text game called Amber Mush, which was based on the Amber Diceless system in the novels by Roger Zelazny. I happened to be out in Oklahoma for a year, pursuing but not ever quite achieving a graduate degree at Oklahoma State. Jim invited me down to his place, which was about an hour south of there. Went down every few weekends, played an assassin with a cursed sword in his Birthright game, and there was this thing that he was printing out from his fiction writing classes on his dot matrix printer. Semi-auto magic. It was about this guy named Harry who could throw around spells and talk like Sam Spade.
Very nice.
Then, if you really want to get strict about the gaming part of things, it was the work that Rob Donahue and I did on turning Fudge into Fate and putting that out for free that sort of weirdly got us onto Jim's radar in the gaming sense, because his agent is a gamer chick. Hello, Jennifer. Jim was not sounding too sure about letting people he didn't quite know run off and do something with his intellectual property to turn it into a role-playing game. He said, don't you know some, like, award-winning RPG designer guys? Talk to them. So Jim approached us instead of the other way around. And, of course, we've gone and turned it into the, as some people have jokingly referred to it, the Duke Nukem of the pen and paper RPG world. Because it's not out yet.
Ah, yes, and it's kind of continued to be not out for a while.
Yeah. When it comes down to it, when Jim came to us, we were nowhere near ready to be publishers.
I see.
It just kind of fell on our laps, and we're like, well, we'd really like to do this, but we have no experience whatsoever. But sure, we'll get this done in a couple of years, right? No.
As I remember when you guys first started to talk about it on the Fate List, and
yeah.
That was a while ago. You were a lot younger then.
Exactly. But it took us the intervening time to build the skills that were necessary.
So when you talk about skills, are you talking about publishing skills, layout skills, game design skills, all of that?
Yes.
Okay.
I'd happily say all of the above, but primarily the main thrust of it was getting the experience of how to publish. I had some layout skills under my belt. They were old and rusty, so I had to get those spun up. But those were almost secondary to the whole business of publishing element. I can safely say that if we had done everything else right and had had the game ready to roll within a year of getting the rights, we would have absolutely goofed up publication of that from getting the business elements of it right.
Just in terms of getting distribution set up or...
Sure, elements of that. What's involved in getting a print job done, navigating the new and scary world, which was actually very young at the time, of print-on-demand for those elements. Figuring out what to do with the still maturing PDF market, all of that stuff. It was 100% dark territory to us, since mainly what we had done up to that point was do something for free and put it up on a website.
Fred, you are sort of employed by the gaming industry, is that true?
On the one hand, I'm self-employed. I'm doing the work for Evil Hat and One Bad Egg. That generates a little bit of income for me, but not a whole lot. And I work about 8 to 10 hours a week also for Indie Press Revolution, doing their customer service queue and some of the website work and stuff like that. Beyond that, I do the occasional freelancing layout job. So I'm employed by the extreme fringes of the industry, and I wouldn't say yet that it's paying me the lofty sums of McDonald's wages.
You're not even up to that point yet.
I suppose I should write a book at some point titled How to Make Dozens of Dollars the Hard Way. You do it for love more than you do it for money.
You've got this interesting take on Spirit of the Century coming out for Christmas, Spirit of the Season. Why don't you tell us about that?
Spirit of the Season was something that last Christmas I had this idea of reimagining Santa and his reindeer as pulp heroes. So he was Nick Saint, codenamed Secret Santa, and he had his cadre of reindeer who would dress up in strange little masks and go out and fight crime and all of that. While I had the high concept down pretty good, I was not the man for the job to actually get all the color text humming exactly right. So I turned to Chad Underkoffler, whose indie supers game, Truth and Justice, had at least some conceptual overlap with this, and said, hey, why don't we do a dual-statted Spirit of the Century / Truth and Justice crossover built around this concept? And since it's for Christmas, let's just give away the PDF version of it for free, at least until the end of the year, as a kind of thank you to all the folks who've made our games bigger than we ever thought they'd be.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that worked out pretty well. We got the attention of Daniel M. Perez from High Moon Media at the time because we had not paid much attention to the Hanukkah side of things. That would have been fine from his perspective, but what we did was we actually talked a little bit about Hanukkah. He would have preferred a complete absence or to actually dive into it. So we said, okay, well, we're working on turning Spirit of the Season into an actual printed supplement that will start selling a little bit later into 2008. Why don't you rough out some ideas from the Hanukkah side of things, since you're more of an expert than Chad or myself would be. He did, and we went back and forth. Chad worked on that stuff, and we did the statting up of things and added in a few new cool features so that the print product would have something extra to offer over what the free version that we had given out in Christmas 2007. I think that came out sometime around April. Christmas for tax season. And it's been sort of a tiny little side thing for Spirit of the Century. It was the first, and I think right now, only supplement that we have for that game, although we've had several irons in the fire for Spirit of the Century supplements that, due to the availability of the people who are going to be working on them, just haven't come around again. That seems to be a bit of a theme for Evil Hat. We are cursed by time.
Well, that's true for anybody who's doing a project on the side, basically.
Yeah, it's been a fun little thing. We've sold nearly 400 copies of that now.
Oh, that's pretty good for a product like that.
Especially given that a lot of the original material was out there for free.
Yeah, very good. One of the things that's intrigued me about Spirit of the Century, which I've played quite a bit of, is that you took a system that is pretty much the only system that I know of that said, you know, all those polyhedral dice that you've got, forget them. In fact, any dice you can get with Monopoly, forget those too. You're going to have special dice for this game because that's how we roll. Why pick a game that needs special dice? And then why take a system like Fudge and blow it out given that particular mechanical quirk?
The dice came with Fudge. And Fudge was our launching point. Fate kind of finds its genesis in a lot of Amber-themed gaming online for years before we actually physically lived near each other. Around the time that I was set to run a game or two, set in Amber, I was kind of moving past the Amber Diceless system. I wanted a little bit of randomness back into things. And Fudge was a system that I'd been tinkering with on and off throughout college. You know, it was originally came about through Usenet news groups. Stefan O'Sullivan kind of captained the effort there, but it was a donated effort by a lot of people, available for free, and was very much the toolbox for building the game that you wanted out of pieces parts. So when I decided that I wanted to do a not Amber Diceless Amber game, I ran a game called Crown of Amber using Fudge as the central engine for that. And that went on for a while and worked out pretty well, but didn't have any of the elements necessarily that ultimately ended up being in Fate. What ended up being in Fate was the result of a couple of years after that game, Rob and I driving back from a vacation that we and our wives had taken out to the Lake Tahoe area, suddenly getting into deep geek about what we would want to do with Fudge if we were going to do another Amber game. And that ended up being the car ride in which we hit upon what we wanted to do with Aspect, at least in their original, somewhat different, but still conceptually similar form. And from that came a game called Born to be Kings.
Fred and I sort of coexisted in the Amber community at the same time, and I remember the fact that he was sort of a pioneer / heretic. At that time, you were the one guy who was saying, Amber is cool, but do we have to use this system?
I was eager for a little heresy at the time.
Not even really engaging that conversation, just saying without any apology, here's the system that's got dice in it, and not really looking for any validation or anything, this is just going to be my thing.
When you're doing something based off of a Fudge, you already know that it's something that you're going to be able to share with the world because it comes from very much a culture of do it for free, man. And I wanted that. I wanted an element of this is going to be the system that is a web page. Folks can come along and adopt it for their own and change it however they want. That's very much the culture and it's all cool.
When you were taking bits and pieces from Fudge and its free love aesthetic, did you ever consider maybe switching to a different sort of dice scheme?
Sure.
Well, you're a system wonk. My impression of Fred is that I would not believe him if he said that he didn't consider six different ways of hacking the system that involved different dice.
We considered all sorts of things, but you know, when it came down to it, we knew that we were building from Fudge and that that had an existing fan base and community around it, and you don't necessarily want to so radically change it that you have nobody who wants to come along for the ride.
Amber had a lot of player authorship hardwired into it, not because of the system, but because of the setting.
Yep, because you're people who walk between worlds and can create whole new realities because you wanted to vacation somewhere with beaches of blue sand.
Regardless of what system you do Amber with, you've got to kind of allow the players that freedom, otherwise you're really not doing Amber.
Yep, it didn't just stop there. Amber is the first game that I remember codifying the notion of players running off and drawing pictures or writing short stories about the game world that were then accepted into the game world. Not only were they accepted into the game world, but it was how you got some extra character points.
Yeah. Now, today, the traditional blue booking, they call it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that kind of collective ownership of the setting was many, many people's first taste of the idea of delegated authority and all sorts of different things.
It's interesting that it took a specialized setting to change people's whole view of how role-playing games should be or could be.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the magic of the late Eric Ujic, right? He also presented a system in which he mercilessly encouraged people to compete with each other in really go-for-the-throat sort of way, starting with character creation, and was also pretty gleefully enthusiastic about GMs making life as difficult for the characters as possible, especially if, God forbid, they took bad stuff on their sheet. I had the privilege of playing in a convention one-shot of Amber run by Eric at AmberCon Northwest a number of years ago. And I think it was within the first half hour that I had lost my left arm. My in-character sister had to plead with him to let me not bleed out.
Nice.
And that was just because I'd kind of gotten in the guy's way.
Most of your games have a means by which there isn't free-form player authorship where everyone's just sort of riffing like the pool.
No, we like the idea that the GM still has some authority and the ultimate guiding hand.
Most of the games that I've seen you guys do have a way for the players to raise their hand and say, I'd like to include this.
Yep.
Is that where it grew out of, was just the fact that when you first envisioned it, it was for a setting where they had to be able to do that, you know?
Yeah, there's always been that element in Amber role-playing of some degree of player authorship. Rob had been digesting a lot of 7C at the time, and 7C had a lovely idea of you actually had to pay character points for your disadvantage. Because whenever those things showed up, they meant that you got the spotlight and you could generate some additional currency or whatever to make things work in your favor. That felt to us like the right way to deal with the fact that nearly anything, particularly in the Amberverse, is something that could be twisted to your disadvantage or could be twisted to your advantage in the right circumstances. It let us be a little bit agnostic about the idea of whether or not your penchant for carousing was a benefit or a curse. It could be both. The irony on all of this of aspects coming from 7C is that 7C was written by John Wick, and John Wick took aspects and worked them into his recent Houses of the Blooded game. Aspects traveled full circle from 7C to Houses of the Blooded.
Very good. It's nice that the community is such that that kind of stuff can happen and everybody's excited about it and not torqued off.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what is it that made you take a step back from the dicelessness of Amber and say, I'd really like to have some more rules around this and some randomness around this?
Just not enough granularity when it came down to it. There are four stats, and the rules tech enthusiastically asserted every single stat is the most important stat. I understood it as a good way to provide a little bit of seeming system authority on paper, but it was the sort of thing that ultimately tended to break down into, okay, I'm getting into the situation, but it's pretty clear who's going to have the advantage going into it, and there's really not anything external. Essentially, there was no element of chance that could bend this circumstances, no matter how much narrative weight I throw at it.
When you say there's no element of chance, is that sort of a way of saying there's no element of the unknown, of excitement, of
kind of
energy?
When it came down to it, Rob and I both really wanted that element of, I have no idea whether I'm going to roll -4, +2, on this and radically changed my circumstances. We missed that a bit, but at the same time, we recognized that there was an element of, you know, when somebody throws their 75 points into warfare, they're kind of wanting to say, I don't want there to be a question about whether or not I win a sword fight. So we said, well, okay, we'd like there to be a question, but we'll at least give you the tools to bend circumstance a little bit more in your favor when you're in a sword fight, because you'll take the swordmaster aspect. Aspects were real multitasker for us in a lot of ways. They were all of these things that I've mentioned before, but they were also a way for us to let people bend the dice a little bit and not have it be something that was purely beholden to just utterly random chance.
So does that mean that the future is some sort of weird hybrid between Amber Diceless and D&D that sort of comes to the middle on that? Or?
Maybe, you know, or maybe we already have that in 100 different ways.
Looking at the lifetime sales numbers of the products from Evil Hat, Don't Rest Your Head has like 1,800 copies sold. Satsi has like 3,100 copies sold. Mm-hmm. How does that sit in the world of products like that? I mean, is that a lot? Is it a little?
Spirit of the Century's numbers are really big from a indie games perspective, from a micropress or microbrewery, how I like to say it, perspective, and not quite all that super impressive from a small but in distro second-tier publisher, so to speak. On the other hand, there are sales that have largely been gotten by not going through the three-tier distribution system. So when you start to factor that in, it looks like a solid, respectable, small product from one of the larger players, but not the largest.
Because you didn't go through that three-tier distribution model, does that mean that your individual per-item profit is considerably better?
Yes, though that then gets mitigated by the costs of going print-on-demand for the production method, because your cost per unit when you're going print-on-demand is higher.
Gotcha. In general, you're probably making per unit the same sort of profit that someone who's running a 10,000 item run is doing. They're just soaking a lot of it into the distribution instead of the printing.
I mean, Spirit of the Century success has absolutely given us a strong bedrock to fund most of the likely very large printing costs of Dresden Files when we get it out.
Okay.
And that was something we never expected. We never expected it to honestly sell more than a few hundred copies. And the fact that it shot over 1,000 and then over 2,000 and then over 3,000 as fast as it has, it's the sort of thing that I look at it and part of my brain can understand it. The rest of it is just in shock.
Because you had to imagine that for every copy that sold, there's probably a whole gaming group playing off that one copy or whatever.
Yeah.
In a lot of cases. So that's a whole lot of people playing the game, right? Yeah.
I think it's partly because, I mean, Tim and I have said this in previous conversations, that like Fred and Rob, who are the quintessential indie traditional gaming fence sitters, which I think is a phrase they've given themselves.
Oh, yeah. We, much like Chad Underkoffler, are too indie for the mainstream and too mainstream for indie.
Yeah.
And we're happy to find that slot because we think there are a lot of people there who really, more than anything, love role-playing and want to cross-pollinate ideas from as many different games as they can.
Yeah. And I think that's really, because you get so many folks that are like, well, I play D&D, I play Vampire, and I like Spirit of Century. It doesn't creep me out too much. And you've got the indie guys who are, I love the traditional values of it, and I love that I can hack the heck out of it.
Right.
For me, that was where a lot of the popularity came from, because it didn't matter who I had at my table from the folks that were, around here. And most folks were going to find something that they loved in it.
Well, right. We were talking about the idea of player authorship through Amber and so forth, and that being part of our roots. But coming from the Fudge roots, you have very much the idea of system authorship and system ownership. With everything that we've done with Fate, we've always taken the tack with the public of, yes, we've gotten it to this point. Now you own this as much as we do. Your ideas for how you want to change it and so forth, we aren't going to respond to those like, oh, those are unsupported and strange.
Let's go ahead and move on into the world of D&D supplements. Since Evil Hat straddles that line between the indie game and the mainstream game, you've decided, hey, you know what? We produced one of the biggest indie games out there. Let's go ahead and produce stuff for the biggest role-playing game out there.
Yeah.
So why?
Ultimately, as with many things, it comes down to what Rob gets excited about. It was pretty clear to me that not only Rob was getting really excited about 4th edition, so was I, but perhaps not quite to the same extent, at least at the time. But also, the story games crowd was getting really excited about 4th edition.
It was like watching a firestorm. It was amazing.
It was amazing. And, and if anything, it is that crowd, I think, that has been some of the more enthusiastic adopters of the new edition. As you rightly labeled me earlier in this conversation, I am a huge system wonk. And whether or not the organization was done quite as well as we would have liked, there are layers upon layers of elegance in the design of 4th edition system that really just excited the hell out of me when I started digging into it to try to figure out what the hell is it that Rob's on about. Rob had already kind of, with Spirit of the Century, he had made his major push with Fate stuff, and he kind of wanted to step back from that and to see him wake up again and start saying, there's a lot of stuff I want to do with this. I'm like, well, let's see what we can do to produce some stuff for it. Then the whole GSL thing came about.
Yeah, which was pretty heartbreaking for a lot of people who had been really cranking on the publishing.
But it wasn't that hard to look at it and say, well, you know, if you want to do third-party support for D&D, it's pretty clear that if this is the license that we have, and our choice is do nothing or do something with this license, the right way to go is to form a separate company. So you can essentially firewall all of the intellectual property you have that is not D&D related from any sort of legal action. The GSL in some ways is the one bad egg. Although One Bad Egg, as named, turns out to operate on a lot of levels. You know, ETG is Gary Gygax's initials.
Mm-hmm.
And the Bad Egg versus Evil Hat thing, you know, kind of appropriated some of the idea that, yes, the intellectual property might be firewalled, but the intellects aren't.
Yeah.
Rather than building one big robot, you built a bunch of little robots so that if WotC decides they suddenly want to unload a cease and desist on one thing,
yep,
it's really kind of detached from everything else.
Yeah. They come along and say, oh, we're producing a giant thing called the Ape Lords, and you're going to have to change your name. We're like, well, okay, cool. We can change it here.
And it doesn't affect
one,
anything.
And lose one product for a time and not lose all of our stuff. There's a lot to be said for doing third-party support almost solely in an electronic venue. I mean, yes, we'd like to be able to ultimately maybe do, you know, one or two print-on-demand versions that collect some of our material in thematic groups or here's all of the Shroud stuff or whatever. But electronic means easy in, easy out, no inventory. And I really think that, at least in the current climate of the version of the GSL that we have to run with right now, is pretty much the way to go.
Well, and the no inventory thing prevents the company ruinous stuff that happened in the 90s with a lot of products where, you know, you end up with somebody sitting on millions of dollars worth of inventory and they just can't unload it and the whole company goes under as a result.
Right, exactly.
I just find it fascinating that when we talked about how the Amber setting influenced the way that the rules were written, and now the GSL has influenced the whole way you're producing products.
Sure, yeah. But, you know, it was really interesting to watch the reactions to the GSL and to see big guys, you know, Ronin Arch, Green Ronin, and a few others pretty much diving out of the way of it and saying no more of this.
Yeah.
Because to us, that felt like a big frickin' vacuum.
Oh, I totally agree. And we still have a huge vacuum.
I think One Bad Egg is doing its own part to fill that a little bit. But when it comes right down to it, you know, A, we don't have a huge amount of exposure yet. And the economy's current performance is not exactly helping that either.
Yeah.
There's some third-party support around. But, I mean, I think the GSL, from a tactical strike standpoint, in terms of saying, hey, let's allow for some third-party support, but let's make absolutely sure it's not something that encourages the kind of metastatic, huge explosion of D20 product like we saw last time around. It's absolutely successful in that regard.
Yes, perhaps too successful.
Right, yeah. There are many, many things left unsaid in that statement.
One Bad Egg has got a couple of lines, I guess you'd call them, the World Seeds line and then the Hard Boiled Ideas line.
Call those lines, they're really just sort of concepts. They're the left hook and the right hook of our approach. But both of them are built around the idea of doing stuff that is highly modular, that, you know, when it has setting elements in it, it's setting elements that are easy for you to reskin and graft onto your game world of choice. While the Shroud has a point of view, has a perspective on what elements of setting it's doing. It's a lot of undead stuff and weird fog that changes things and elements of dark, pulpy horror going on with it.
You had me at undead.
The one thing that I did find interesting is I was sort of exploring the World Seeds product that you have out, which is called The Shroud. It's a number of little products. One of them is sort of a Book of Gods, and then there's some player races, including the Ape Lord. I didn't really see a product that sort of said, here's the Shroud setting. There's the webpage of the Shroud that outlines there's this world and this fog came down. There's no product that seems to go into detail of that.
Right, and that's somewhat intentional right now. I mean, yes, we'll essentially be coloring in around the edges of things, hinting at elements of a larger setting with every single product that is within that world seed. But the idea is that those are hints that if you're wanting something to be there, it's largely on you to go then and make something be there. It's not a, here's gobs and gobs and gobs and gobs of predetermined setting information that might ultimately leave you feeling penned in. It's, hey, here are some interesting ideas. Drop them onto your world of choice. Build a world of your own out from that, whatever. We just feel it's a little bit truer to how a lot of DMs, not all of them, but a healthy chunk of them, encounter setting material. Not, hey, I'm going to go run something in the Forgotten Realms. It's, hey, I'm going to grab this spell scarred idea from the Forgotten Realms Player's Guide and make it make sense in the world that I'm
your assumption is that most people have like the starter kit or their own kit of assembled Lego pieces, and you're just providing another couple of bags of brightly colored blocks that they can toss into the mix with their stuff that they already have on the table.
Yeah, and as it turns out, I mean, certainly from the feedback we've gotten, a few of One Bad Egg's biggest fans, I think, were in many cases already running something that had some element that resonated with the idea of great big evil fog comes along and causes the dead to rise. In some cases, it's a campaign where a strange shadow that has fallen upon the land instead of a fog. Well, that's real easy to swap out. And I think it's easy to swap out because we're not hardwiring so much elements of setting color in there that you're pulling out tons and tons and tons of material in order to get the one thing that you want to adopt. We're providing you a sprout. We're not providing you an oak.
With what Tim's doing with Northmoor, he's doing a lot of the Lego work around and then leaving these big open gaps saying, okay, this specifically right here, this is the stuff where you put your own Lego pieces in and build what you want so that your thing is completely different.
I sort of have the leafless tree, and One Bad Egg stuff is more like leaves you can stick on the tree.
Sure, yeah, exactly. On the hard-boiled side, that's really just kind of acknowledging that occasionally what you want is something that goes deep on a particular topic. I want to do an empire of poisoners and assassins. Well, Poisoncraft, which is one of the hard-boiled ideas that we're mucking around with thanks to Justin Jacobson's work, would be a good fit for you. Also, I was talking recently with Jonathan Walton of 1001. He had pointed me at a post over on Story Games by a guy named Simon Carrier talking about ways to randomly generate culturally diverse and interesting NPCs with just a few kind of, here's your list of cultural norms, draw a few cards out of a deck. Well, he and I got to talking about that in the concept of Dungeons & Dragons races. Started talking about how it would be interesting to be able to take three or four races and say, okay, now let's make these culturally diverse in a way that actually has meaning that's reinforced by system. We're about 48 hours into that conversation and 7,000 words later. And that's probably going to be a product coming out in the next couple of months that is basically hard-boiled cultures, which is going to give you a chance to basically say, okay, no, there's one configuration for what an elf race is. There are 12. And each of these elements is, you know, a meaningful decision about your own identity as a person within that culture and so forth. And it's actually going to be reinforced in terms of what it does to the stats on your character sheet.
But that reminds me a lot of how the races are represented in Shadow of Yesterday, which in a way is sort of a second cousin to Spirit of the Century.
Shadow of Yesterday, at least its latest revision, uses fudge dice, but is even more excessively drifted from fudge than Fate is.
Now that you've had some time to really get your hands in 4E in a way that a lot of people don't get to, and you know, the fact that you're designing products using the system and that sort of thing, I mean, you've obviously got your fingers pretty deep in the systems. 4E is definitely built to be extensible in a way that the previous versions of the game haven't. Some of the stuff that I've seen in the One Bad Egg products really takes advantage of that extensibility in terms of multi-classing and that sort of thing. Have you found it easier to extend 4E than previous versions of the game?
Feats are about as easy. What in third edition were prestige classes are much harder from a design perspective, fourth edition, because fourth edition has this defined power progression. It's actually a lot of rules material that you need to generate to do a multi-class or something like that. It's the low 20s of powers you need to produce for a complete multi-class that runs end-to-end from level 1 to 30. A multi-class can get away with doing one or two powers per level. Often you'll see them go potentially a little bit more. Right out the gate, we're talking 40-some-odd powers, right? The Shroudborn multi-class, which I added a second track of powers to after my first run through it, was, to my eye, a little too threadbare. Comes out the gate with 45 powers in total. And that's actually not minimalist, but close to minimalist for a multi-class implementation. If you want to do a full-on class of your own, like what Rob Donahue is trying to do with the Witch Doctor, you're looking at something even more sprawling. So from a class design perspective, it's a lot more work. When you kind of atomize that, and you go down to the idea of creating a few additional fighter at wills, or a warlock pact, or something like that, that's still some work, but it's not as heavy. And that's the level in which I think it perhaps has parity with prestige classes of third edition.
I totally understand what you're saying in terms of if you're going to add a whole new class or something, the sheer amount of material you have to write to make that complete is vast compared to even third edition.
Outside of character power elements, you're starting to look at things like monsters and encounter design and stuff like that. And that, I feel, is vastly easier than it was in third edition, in part because the structure of things is more exposed and better documented and all of that. So you're ending up with a fairly clear idea of how to build an appropriate Monster of the Week that you need for your next session. The Monster Manual shows some evidence of the issues that come with a product early in the cycle rather than later in the cycle after enough body of play has developed. But you can still reasonably reliably take your experience budget for building an encounter, look at the Monster Manual, and very quickly put together something that is appropriate to your group. That stuff is just crazy interesting.
When you're sitting down to design new powers for a class, for example, how do you find the process of statting out one of those powers compared to coming up with what a feat could be? One of the things that people talked about in 3E is, well, how good is a feat? And there was really no sort of measurable way to say a feat should let you do this much stuff. It should be this good.
Yeah, I think if you sit down and read enough powers at a given level, you want to do a new level one at willpower, and you look at three or four different classes worth of those, and you know, make sure that you're looking specifically at the ones that come with a role that lines up with the one that you're talking about. So look at striker powers if you're coming up with an at-will striker. There are some principles that emerge pretty quickly in terms of the amount of damage that tends to be dealt out, what sort of effects tend to be viable versus off-limits and usually only found in an encounter or a daily power, things like that. You don't have at-will powers that blind people, because blinded is considered a pretty potent condition. You don't have many powers that do a slide, but you might have ones that do pull or push.
What are you and Rob really finding that intrigues you about the mechanical parts of the game?
What I most love playing with is doing something interesting with the combination of elements of battlefield control, like forced movement, elements of mobility, and playing around with the synergy that can exist between certain conditions, particularly the conditions that will offer combat advantage, because of how that fits into a number of different class abilities that want you to have combat advantage on a target, things like that. There are ways that the system interlocks with itself. You might break it down to all of its core elements, and you've got a bunch of fairly simple things that by themselves, they're not complicated and they don't do much by themselves, but you take two or three of those and get them in combination with one another in sequence, playing off of each other to create some sort of opposition. And that's where you get some really interesting complexity arising from very simple building blocks. And that's something that, as a system wonk, I'm always pretty excited about. I'm suddenly excited about minis and maps and stuff like I never have been. Like, at no point in my gaming life have I been as excited about rolling out the frickin' battle mat as I have this past year.
You can do a lot of very interesting, dynamic set-piece battles that 4.0 really lets you do some kind of amazing stuff with.
Amazing elements of the terrain being almost a character in its own right, especially, like I said, forced movement powers and powers that get you momentary, unusual mobility, all adds up to fights in 4E feeling far more dynamic than any previous edition of Dungeons & Dragons has for me. For all I know, once we get that guy bloodied, he's going to explode and turn into three creatures, and we're all going to get pushed back five squares. And now it's kind of a rapid, okay, how do we deal with this fact? We can't flank him anymore. What's the situation there? It feels like the changing tactical elements of battle as opposed to a numbers game. If you look at a lot of the advice in the Dungeon Master's Guide, and this is where I think you got a lot of that hubbub on story games coming from.
Yeah, definitely.
The advice, the soft stuff, where they tell the DM, here's the right way to be a DM, or at least a way we think that would be good. A lot of that stuff reads as to court controversy a little bit, post-indie.
They definitely have been reading some other books other than what Watsu's put out.
Yeah, it's intelligently built upon the last 20 years of RPG thought. If somebody says, you know, I really want X to happen, can I spend an action point for it? Whenever a system presents currency, it is likely to get interacted with like a fate point in my local playgroup for some reason. There are a lot of ways you can get elements of player authorship into your D&D without necessarily going quite as whole hog as you'll see in a lot of small press indie stuff. The absolute minimum of dipping your toe into player authorship waters, I think, is to come to the table with absolutely no names for your NPCs and say, okay, who knows a blacksmith? What's his name? Okay. And going there. And often, at least with a certain segment of fairly creative players, you'll end up with a little bit of backstory getting generated there, right? You don't necessarily have to generate it at the time that they're saying, oh, yeah, I know Gus the blacksmith. But you can, as the conversation is going on, you go three or four sentences of dialogue, and then you go, so how is it that you know Gus? Just by doing a little bit of almost Socratic question and answer about this NPC that you're bringing in there, you're actually you're allowing yourself as a GM to actually sit back and not do as much of the backstory design work for your session, and you're giving that player an opportunity to feel like he owns the relationship with that NPC more fully,
right.
And he's probably more likely to call on that NPC later on, so you end up building your world. And I think that sort of stuff is easy to drop into any game. There was a beach vacation I went away on earlier this year. Some of these people going on it wanted to play some D&D while they were there, and I'm like, oh, I'll run it, why not? I don't know half of you, and that's fine. My one condition for running this is that there need to be pre-gens, and I need to not be the one putting them together. So one of the other players said, I'll take care of that. So he got all of the basic characters put together. So I'm going into it. I haven't seen any of the characters or anything like that, and there's no reason for there to be any sort of backstory amongst them. We sit down, the first scene opens, and I say, okay, so all of you are tied to the stakes around this bubbling cauldron, and the natives are dancing. And I point at one of the players at the table and say, and this is the guy who got you into it. And then I turn to him and say, but why do you blame the guy to your left? And they did a circle of blame all the way around the table. So the last guy, and so the last player at the table, the last person to get blamed, was also the person I said, well, it's a good thing that you're just about to break free of your bonds. Through that exercise, everyone got to throw in an element of describing their character, getting everyone familiar with them.
Why I hate you.
And producing a little bit of backstory for why this group was together, whether or not they were happy with being together. And then they had the great big fun rescue fight that proceeded from that. It's a long-standing tradition between Rob and myself and our gaming groups of starting things out with, okay, you saved the life of the person to your right. Figure out why. You figure out why you owe the person to your left, what you owe the person to your left for doing that. And you sit back for half an hour or an hour of your first session, and you've got real relationships and good backstory that you didn't have to do any work to produce as a GM. So once everyone's gotten that sorted out, you say, okay, here are some index cards. Write down your perspective on these three things on them and pass them back to me. And now you've got a deck that you can shuffle out every now and then of going, okay, this plot element shows up. Oh, look, you have a tie to the mob. Awesome.
For the One Bad Egg products, since you've got sort of a whole long list of micro products, if you will, buying them all individually is good if you want to just pick and choose, but if you want the whole thing, what are you doing to address people who want that?
As I was saying earlier, we are hoping that at some point we may be able to do a little bit of the collected shroud as a single print-on-demand volume or something like that as one possibility for offering the bundles of things. This is something that a number of our fans have asked us about. Once you know what we're doing with One Bad Egg, if it particularly excites you, you know you're pretty much going to buy everything that we put out. There are a number of people out there who want to be able to pay some amount of money up front and just get the stuff. The problem from our perspective at One Bad Egg is that because we have the almost freewheeling attitude towards put out the products that we happen to discover through play, we're going to do this world seed thing, and sometimes we're going to put out a big product, and sometimes it's going to be small, and so forth. It doesn't really necessarily support a straight-up subscription idea of, okay, we know that we're going to put out exactly $25 worth of products in 3 months.
Right, and you don't want to discourage yourself from putting out extra stuff if you feel like it, and you don't want to feel compelled to put out enough to make it worth people's while if life gets in the way or whatever.
Right. So what we're prototyping right now, what we've actually got at www.onebadegg.com/bookshelf is a beta of a system that basically lets you buy a certain amount of bookshelf credit up front, and if you buy $25 worth or more, you'll actually get a discount off of that. So you're spending, I think, like $23.75 to get $25 worth of credit. You can then pick and choose out of our catalog what you want of that credit. It kind of gives us a little bit of that extra operating capital up front and gives us that vote of confidence. I'm interested in you this much. And it's also a way for us to pass some savings on to them. That's about as good of a compromise as we've been able to figure.
So is that bookshelf thing up and running for people to go ahead and use now?
Or? It's in beta. I kind of slyly mentioned it on my live journal when I was talking about the Shroudborn multi-class release, which is not actually linked in on the site yet because it is beta and we're kind of wanting it to more trickle out as a word of mouth thing.
Okay.
And it definitely doesn't have every single one of its features that it could have there, but we figure if we slowly get a few more people using it because they listen to this podcast or read my live journal, that'll let us ease into making it the best possible venue for selling our stuff.
Alrighty. Well, Fred, thanks so much for taking some time to chat with us, and I want to encourage everybody to go check out the onebadegg.com site and see the various sorts of 4E products that are starting to come out. There's not a lot of third-party stuff out there now, and this is a great chance to kind of get in the ground floor of what Fred and Rob and the other guys there are doing.
Well, thank you very much for having me. This is good fun, even though I ran off at the mouth a bit at times.